Well, hello there, and welcome to the iFormerX podcast. This is Stuart Haynes, the editor-in-chief of iFormerX. iFormerX is a community of practice where we explore the evidence that informs ambulatory care, community, and geriatric pharmacy practice. And if you're not already a member of iFormerX, it's easy to join, and it's free. Just head on over to our website, iFormerX.org, and click on the Join or Sign In link in the upper right of the navigation bar. I've got to admit, when I first learned about the first GLP-1 receptor agonist, exenatide, when it was approved in 2005, I wasn't very impressed. Yeah, it had a novel mechanism of action, and it seemed to have some weight loss benefits, but it caused a lot of side effects, and it had to be injected, and it was quite expensive. But exenatide paved the way for an entire new therapeutic class that has truly revolutionized not only the treatment of type 2 diabetes, but has significant cardiovascular benefits and renal protection. And just as importantly, the weight loss observed with some of the GLP-1 receptor agonists has proven to be very significant, with 10 to 20% losses in total body weight commonly seen in those who are treated with semaglutide and tirzepatide in clinical trials. Now, weight loss has potentially many health benefits, but most insurers have been kind of reluctant to pay for weight loss drugs because there isn't clear evidence that it improved long-term outcomes or mortality. So when I saw the semaglutide effects on cardiovascular outcomes in people with overweight or obesity trial, which is better known as the SELECT study, published in the New England Journal of Medicine in December 2023, I reached out to Greg Castelli at the University of Pittsburgh to review this landmark paper. And Greg, in turn, invited Drake Meany to be his co-author. Dr. Castelli is an associate professor in the Department of Family Medicine and co-lead for Interprofessional Education Thread at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Dr. Meany is a PGY2 ambulatory care resident at UPMC St. Margaret Hospital and is currently completing a faculty development fellowship. So, Greg, Drake, it's wonderful to have you both here on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Stuart. Really appreciate the invite.
Really excited to be here, Stuart. Thanks for having us.
So, Greg, I'd like to put the SELECT study into some perspective. We've had a number of drugs available for weight loss for like 60 plus years. And prior to the GLP-1 receptor agonist, most drugs were associated with modest but clinically important weight loss. Most people could expect a weight loss of 5 to 8% of total body weight. So that's like 10 to maybe 15, perhaps 20 pounds for some patients. But the GLP-1 receptor agonists are producing weight loss that's rivaling bariatric surgery. And while there has been a lot of enthusiasm for these drugs among the lay public, I think most practitioners and particularly insurers are a bit more skeptical. So I'm hoping you can give us a little history lesson about weight loss drugs and why there's so much skepticism about them.
Yeah, happy to. So the desire to lose weight by pharmacotherapy goes back decades, as you mentioned. We may not even have metformin unless there was that precursor fenformin in the 70s and 80s. Include that with other medications like phentermine, bupropion, naltrexone, topiramate, and orlistat, and various combinations of all of those, and you have quite the attempt to lose weight. I agree with your assessment in that most of those medications historically produce modest weight loss over a short period of time. And some of these classes of medications are only FDA approved for 12 weeks. When you look at these trials, virtually all of them do not target cardiovascular disease outcomes, but rather weight loss and BMI reductions. Side effects vary from class for the potential of abuse and increase in sympathomimetic response of phentermine, to blood pressure and heart rate increases in bupropion naltrexone, psychiatric effects of topiramate, and GI distress of orlistat. So these medications also don't come without risk. Now, when it comes to GLP-1s, we don't disagree about the promise these medications hold for weight loss. I think we just need data about the implications for patients without diabetes, and that's where this SELECT trial comes in. I also want to mention two points of the unknown regarding GLP-1s. The first is that there are some reports and anecdotal reports that when folks stop taking GLP-1 agents for weight loss, the weight tends to come back ferociously, and sometimes patients can gain more weight than where they were before they lost it. And the second point that I want to point out of an unknown is we really don't know how much of the weight loss is actually a loss in muscle mass. There are some reporting out there that 30 to 40% of the total body weight loss is actually muscle mass, and that has counterintuitive effects that you might want for patients. The final thing I want to just throw out there in my opening remarks is just a call for all practitioners listening. Try to read up about why we as a society are overweight and how our food system from the farming to table is causing this issue. Start to implement some changes yourself. And talk to your patients so that you're better prepared to enter this discussion with them, because oftentimes it's not just one medication, it comes with a lifestyle adjustment.
Yeah, so Drake, let's take a closer look at the SELECT study. And as I mentioned, the study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in December 2023. Its official title is Semaglutide and Cardiovascular Outcomes in Obesity Without Diabetes. Of course, we provide a link to the original study on our website, and we hope everyone will read it. But can you give us a brief summary of the study methods and some of the key findings?
Yeah, when we look at the SELECT study, really it evaluated semaglutide and its effect on cardiovascular outcomes in patients with overweight or obese diagnoses and pre-existing ASCVD, but without diabetes. They enrolled just under 18,000 patients, with about 8,800 in each group. And baseline characteristics were quite similar between the groups. Average age was 62 years old. Average BMI was 33. And two-thirds of the patients actually met the pre-established ASCVD criteria due to a previous myocardial infarction only. So no non-fatal stroke, no other kind of cardiovascular indicator. Another thing to mention is that 90% of the patients that were included in the study were on lipid-lowering therapy, so practically everybody. And then two-thirds of the patients in the study had pre-diabetes. And so after about just over 3 years of follow-up, the primary cardiovascular endpoint was a composite of death from cardiovascular causes, non-fatal MI, or non-fatal stroke. And there was a 1.5% difference in favor of the semaglutide group with a number needed to treat of 67. This result was driven largely by non-fatal myocardial infarction. Death from cardiovascular causes and non-fatal stroke did not reach significance. When we look at the secondary outcomes, one of which was a composite heart failure outcome, so death from cardiovascular causes or hospitalization or an urgent medical visit for heart failure, there was a 0.7% difference in favor of the semaglutide group with a number needed to treat of 143. And then another secondary outcome was death from any cause. And with this, there's a 0.9% difference in favor of the semaglutide group with a number needed to treat of 111. Also talking about safety. So how safe is semaglutide? Really what they found was that 1 in 6 patients in the semaglutide group had an adverse event that led to permanent discontinuation of it, more than double the placebo group, which equated to a number needed to harm of 11. And then similar to prior studies, the mean reduction in body weight with semaglutide was about 10%.
So in my introductory remarks, I called the SELECT trial a landmark study. And in part, it's because it's a very large study with like 17,000 participants. And it was an outcome study with major cardiovascular adverse events as the primary endpoint. It was randomized, prospective, blinded, placebo-controlled, so it's got all the right stuff. But are there aspects about the design of the study or the inclusion criteria that you think we really should note? Do any of the secondary endpoints stand out to you? Like, for example, the very significant change in high-sensitivity CRP in the semaglutide group when compared to placebo. And finally, are there any potential confounders in the study that might have impacted the results.
Yeah, I'll get started and then toss it over to Drake. So I think first we need to look at the patients that were included. And patients that were eligible to be included were those with pre-established cardiovascular disease. And I think of this as a very similar inclusion criteria to all the other major GLP-1 and SGLT2 trials that have looked at cardiovascular benefit for folks with diabetes. The outcomes of those trials have shown that if you have cardiovascular disease, you're going to probably have some benefit. What ends up happening, though, as a society is we hear the weight loss and we end up jumping on it. I know from working with the family physicians and residents, the actual outcomes of some of these studies get overblown. So I want to definitely underline that this is for folks that have established cardiovascular disease. The other things to include in the patient population is that 2/3 of folks enrolled in this study had prediabetes. And so it calls into question, is there some dysglycemia that the patients have that's causing them to be at an elevated cardiovascular risk? And this medication's kind of having a double whammy of weight loss and controlling their sugars. When you break it out by the folks that had prediabetes and those that did not, there was slightly less benefit if you didn't have prediabetes. And then the final thing that I just want to throw out there is lifestyle. This study did not include a lifestyle intervention. One thing that I'm counseling patients on when we start medications like this is to incorporate lifestyle. But also, if you're enrolled in this study, you may have a higher level of motivation to go and take the medication because you want to lose weight. And so that might lead to less of a real-world applicability for the trial.
I think another thing to point out about that primary outcome is that composite nature of it. So it looked at death from cardiovascular cause, non-fatal MI, and non-fatal stroke. And I think an inherent crux of any composite outcome is really just if one outcome is driving it, in this case, non-fatal MI, we may be making incorrect assumptions about all components of that composite. And that being said, 2/3 of the patients that were included in this study were included because they had a prior myocardial infarction. And so that was the only component of the primary outcome that significantly decreased. And so I think that that's just one thing to be mindful of when we think about who this drug may be best for.
Yeah, and I think also when you think about starting somebody on a GLP-1 agonist, you're looking for other patient factors to consider. So their GI history, their medication tolerance, things like that.
Another thing that Stuart, you had kind of asked about was if there was any differences between subgroups. And I think one thing to be mindful of, and this is similar to other SGLT2 and GLP-1 studies that have come out in the past, but there is a difference between patients from different geographical regions. So the North American patient population didn't show the same benefit for the primary composite endpoint as the European patient population. And there's a lot of theoretical reasons behind this. I think that you could point to differences in healthcare in the United States, our different diets, differences in physical activity, among a wide variety of other potential factors.
Yeah, and if I may, just to wrap up, you also asked about the C-reactive protein data. You know, I think while there was a difference there, we really think about that as disease-oriented data or DOE data. There were some other secondary outcomes maybe to point out. There was less conversion to diabetes in the folks that were enrolled that had prediabetes. And as Drake alluded to, there were high rates of patients stopping the treatment early and a lot of GI side effect tolerance issues that folks on the treatment group had that those on the placebo did not.
So I believe this is the first weight loss study that has documented a cardiovascular benefit. But is the benefit sufficient to merit making this drug, semaglutide, a standard of care for people with obesity who are at high risk for cardiovascular events? You know, what's the number needed to treat here? I think you already mentioned, but how does that compare to other drugs we routinely recommend to use in this population, like statins and ACE inhibitors and aspirin therapy? And from a public policy perspective, should insurers be required to cover semaglutide and perhaps tirzepatide for the treatment of people with obesity who are at high risk or have pre-existing cardiovascular disease?
Yeah, so I think that those are all really good questions to bring up, Stuart. I think that one thing to think about as far as semaglutide, thinking about it as a standard of care for patients with high risk of cardiovascular events who are obese, probably yes, as far as being a standard of care, with the big caveat that patients with the beginnings of dysglycemia tended to benefit a little bit more from semaglutide as opposed to patients without. And then also patients that had a prior non-fatal MI tended to benefit a little bit more than other patients. So I think that really helps us to kind of think about, as clinicians, helping us to thread the needle as opposed to a widespread approach of everyone gets a GLP-1.
Yeah. And so will this go into the treatment guidelines? Where does it fall in relation to statins and ACE inhibitors and all the other things we think about for cardiovascular disease? We have to think about the places of those therapies, and they're cemented based off the historical data. So, you know, GLP-1 agonists like semaglutide come after that. I think we have to consider the high cost of this medication to patients and to the healthcare system, as well as the adverse events of a high discontinuation rate and GI side effects. So do we think that this is going to be recommended in treatment guidelines? Probably. I can't imagine that in the next iteration of guidelines, they would not recommend these. I think it's probably going to be a very broad approach to helping folks lose weight. And I think it's important for us as providers to think about what that does to the whole system. I don't want to overstate the effects of semaglutide here. Yes, it can help with weight loss, which is really important for patients. But we have a lot of patients that have cardiovascular disease and also diabetes. And so thinking about it in a hierarchical approach, that maybe we should prioritize this medication or this class of medications to go to folks that have diabetes and cardiovascular disease.
One last kind of tidbit about this is, should insurers be required to pay for semaglutide, especially if patients are meeting that inclusion criteria for the study? At the end of the day, I think that we really just need to prioritize semaglutide and other GLP-1s for patients with diabetes, because at this point in time, these medications are not easily accessible. There is a bit of a line or a queue for patients to get these medications. And I think that we need to try and make sure that we're giving people the therapy that would best benefit. And really, with our patients with diabetes, they're getting the best bang for the buck.
And just to wrap up, cynically, I worry what a wide scale implementation for these medications are going to do. I worry that patients that have the ability to pay to play will get access to them and leave those that probably need them behind and in the dust. We didn't talk about the benefits that GLP-1s have in the diabetes population from a cardiovascular standpoint or anything like that today. But I just don't want the message to go out there and that we cause an even further backlog and delay to care.
Well, Drake, Greg, thanks so much for writing the commentary about the SELECT study and joining me today for the iFormRx podcast to discuss the study. I think clearly the GLP-1 receptor agonists have ushered in a new era of anti-obesity treatments that might have some significant health benefits. And while the SELECT study provides some compelling data, I think it's an open question about whether we can afford it as a society, whether people with obesity require lifelong treatment, and whether reliance on medications for weight loss has some unintended consequences. Let us know what you think by posting a comment on iFormRx. And if you like this podcast, please take a moment to rate us on your favorite podcast app and leave a comment. We don't have a marketing budget, so we rely on your word of mouth to spread the news about iFormRx, and your positive comments and five-star ratings really help. And by the way, if you are a board-certified geriatric pharmacist, you can earn board recertification and continuing education credit for listening to this podcast and reading the written commentary. Partnered with the American Pharmacists Association to create the Literature Evaluation evidence-based practice series. And you can learn more by clicking on the link just below the written commentary on our website. And lastly, I want to send a big shout out to Michael Ernst at the University of Iowa College of Pharmacy. Michael has been a strong supporter of iFormRx over the years. He's written commentaries, reviewed commentaries, and participated in podcasts. And Michael has introduced iFormRx to his students and his residents and fellows and colleagues. Michael is someone that we in academia call the triple threat because he's someone who consistently delivers excellence in his scholarship, his teaching, and his service. So thank you, Michael, for all you've done and all that you're doing to advance our profession and our discipline. Well, until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormRx, signing off.